everything's
That's true.
Alright. So today we have told us.
We have a story of great deception that I've never.
Deception.
Yes. Never really understood. Didn't understand it from its perspective of why it is used as a positive. Why it had to be done that way. Is this one of those instances where to learn from this that it's okay for a wife to deceive her husband together with her son in an issue of this magnitude?
There are times when you're allowed to be deceptive. But to state an untruth, the question is that he has is that this seems to be such a critical point, such a monumental thing. Well, it was Rivka and Yaakov both. The issue here is that Yaakov received the brachas under a shadow. He accessed them through a lie. Let me give you two reasons which are given by some of the portion. The Ran, in his drushes, argues a very interesting argument. He says that we say in the Havdalah, Hamavdil bin Kodesh l'chayil, Hamavdil bin Or l'choshech, bin Yisrael l'amim, who separates the holy from the profane, light from darkness, and Israel from the nations. So somebody once said, Hamavdil bin Kodesh l'chayil, who separates between holy and unholy? The Jews. We sanctify the Shabbat. We're the ones who live the distinction between holy and unholy. Bein or lachoshech, between light and darkness, who separates that? God. God's light and darkness. Bein Yisrael lamim, between Israel and the nations, who does that? The nations. The nations are the ones who maintain the tension. They're the ones whose enmity towards us makes sure that we don't disappear. One of the great tragedies for Russian Jewry was the fact that when they emigrated from Russia, they were no longer carrying a card that said that they were Jews, because in Russia they were forced to carry a card that said Jid. And the minute that they didn't have something that identified them as Jews, they began to disappear, they began to assimilate, they no longer had an identity. So for 70 years, as destructive as the Russians were to Judaism, but Jews knew that they were Jews. And the Ran argues that God, at the very outset of the division between the Jewish and non-Jewish world, wanted to make sure that there would be enmity from the nations to Israel so as to sustain their separation. And if the nations were to be too hospitable and friendly, that Jews would assimilate. So he made this momentous event an event that created enmity, so that that enmity would sustain Israel through they would constantly perpetuate this feeling. So the Ran's argument is that the reason that God orchestrated it this way is so that there would be enmity. And if it would have happened on kosher, there wouldn't have been any resentment. One of the Mephoshim says that there's a problem over here, because the brachas were not something that somebody conferred on their own. A bracha that comes from a mortal is mortal. It's limited. A person is not the source of brachas. God is the source of brachas. So here was the problem. The problem is that the divine spirit from which Yitzchok was going to draw the force of these blessings only resides with a person in a context of joy. Ein Hashchina Shoyla Ela Mitech Simcha. The Shechina doesn't come other than if there is joy there. God knew that if the truth were to be revealed to Yitzchak, what a scoundrel Esav was, and that he did not deserve the brachas because of his wickedness, his rishus, that Yitzchak would be crushed, because he was under the impression that Esav was redeemable. So if it would have gone straight, meaning that, I mean, obviously Esav could not have been the legitimate recipient of the brachas. So God would have had to reveal to Yitzchak, Esav doesn't deserve the brachas, he's a Rasha. Legitimately, Yitzchak would have been despondent about it, in which case the Shekhinah could not have been present when he conferred the brachas, because the Shekhinah doesn't come to a place of sadness. So the only way in which this could take place is for him to believe that, in fact, the Shekhinah was with him because Esav, as he himself believed, and not as Rivka argued, was a legitimate beneficiary. He rejoiced about that and conferred the brachas in a context of joy. Otherwise, that wouldn't have happened. So the only way it could have happened is through deception, by his believing that he was giving the brachas. That the only way you can give the brachas is in joy. Avram died the day that Yaakov acquired the Bechora, the right of the firstborn, from Esav. Avram didn't know it. Here's the thing, it's very interesting. It says that God took Avram from the world 5 years prematurely. He should have lived, all the others should have lived 180 years. Yitzchak lived 180 years. Avram was supposed to live 180 years, but he had 5 years subtracted because Esav was about to embark on his career of debauchery and wickedness, and it says that Hashem didn't want Avram to have to witness that, and so he took him 5 years earlier, 5 years before his time. It would have been too painful for Avram. Yeah, so I guess everybody is, especially parents and grandparents, are invested. You want to see things in a certain way. Anyway, I once questioned this by saying that we're told that the neshama continues to be aware of what goes on with this family even after their passing. I mean, you see that Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov are aware of whatever happens to Klal Yisrael. They're constantly running to the divine throne and petitioning God on behalf of Klal Yisrael, so they know what's going on. So what benefit, what did God accomplish by taking him 5 years earlier? If he would have been alive, he would have known. Now that he's dead, he knows. I once said that it seems to me that Avram, of course, was the great, he was the master Makarif. You know, he went all over the world being Makarif people to Hashem, tearing them out of all of their wickedness and bringing them to Hashem. So Hashem knew that if Avram would become aware of the fact that Esav had gone off the derech, that he would then throw himself into trying to be a makar of him, to no avail, because Esav was too invested in his wickedness to be redeemed. And Hashem knew it wasn't the fact that he would see him in his rishus, which would have been excruciating. What was it? I mean, that was painful enough, but what would have been excruciating to Avram would have been his inability to redeem him, which he would have taken on himself. He would have said, if I was a better person, I would have been able to reach him. The point is that if he takes him 5 years earlier, then he can't blame himself for not reaching him, because he's not there. Well, nobody experiences one iota more pain than they deserve. I think that the necessity to take Avram away prematurely was because otherwise he would have faltered himself. I think it's also important to note that even though that the Chazal register Yaakov's deception as a necessary act, they also record the fact that it did not go without having its repercussions. In other words, it was a falsehood, and even though it was a necessary falsehood, and a falsehood that somehow was consistent with the divine plan, but the very fact that it took a form which was not legitimate, that form exacted its price. So Yaakov's life is in fact one where he has this whole incident with Yosef and he's deceived. Let's look at this a little bit. There was no other way. Let me develop one approach. I've done this before. I'll go through it again. Rashi brings to our attention a comment of our sages about how Esav deceived Yitzchak. And they bring some specific examples. Like he would come in and ask these very frum questions. Like, how do you tithe straw? How do you tithe salt? So the Shem Shmuel says, and of course you don't tithe either one of those things, but it does seem like, boy, this guy must really be frum if he's asking these kind of questions. So the Shem Shmuel says that Yitzchak had a certain sense of the fact that Yaakov was a very spiritual person, a very pure soul, very innocent, uncorruptible, and that Esav was a man of the world, a man of the field, a hunter. And like any parent, wanted to be able to see to it that both of his children would have a role or a continuity in Kedusha. So he wasn't worried about Yaakov. But he felt that both in Yaakov's interest and in Esav's interest, if he could bring them together so that Yaakov would be free to dedicate himself totally to Hashem's service, Torah and Avodah, and Esav would, by his attachment to Yaakov, by enabling Yaakov to do that without being distracted by the necessity to earn a living, to go out and deal with the world, do battle, that Esav would become part of the work of Kedusha. So he would be part of, he would be the infrastructure, he would be the support system. In a certain sense, the way many fruits grow is that the edible part, the nourishing part, is protected by something outside of it, sustained by. So you have corn, which is surrounded by a husk, and you have bananas and oranges and apples. They have peels and all kinds of stuff. But there's always something. There's always what they call the klipa, protecting the pre. Now, if the klipa does not assume its own grandiose self-importance and try to compete with the pre, with the fruit, and then you have something which in fact works. But the moment that the klipa, that the peel, or the support structure becomes the essence, that's when it's gone awry and you lost the thing. So he says, so Yitzchak's design was, I'm going to give the blessings to Esav. Esav will have an abundance of all blessings, rich crops, whatever, all of the things that generate the wherewithal, not only to live comfortably, but to be able to support something comfortably. And Esav understood that that was his father's dream. And he knew that his father was vulnerable in that dream, that that's where he could. So he made the kinds of noise. When he went out to the world, he impressed his father with the fact that he was doing that for the sake of being able to sustain Yaakov. One of the things that kind of supported this illusion was when he asked the question, how do you tithe straw and salt? Now, both of those things are not an ikar. Those are not the main thing. Those are just kind of incidental. The straw is there because it's part of what supported the fruit. The salt is there as a spice. It's not the main food. So he was saying, I want to tithe. I want to bring Kedusha. This was the implication of the question. I want to bring Kedusha to salt and straw. In other words, Pop, I understand my role. And my role is to be the spice and the support for Yaakov, who is the Iker. He's the main thing, and I'm gonna... So this is what kind of drew Yitzchak in. Yitzchak was not under the illusion that Esav was somehow more spiritual than Yaakov. He knew Yaakov was pure soul. But his hope was that he was going to be able to support Yaakov, and thereby they would both be redeemed. Rivka knew that he had no such design, no such intent, that he would just soon see Yaakov fall into the ocean, and that he wanted whatever he wanted exclusively for himself. And that if Esau were to get the blessings, that Yaakov would be totally bereft. He would have nothing to be able to sustain his spiritual activities. So she somehow had to get Yaakov in to receive some of the blessings, even though it meant that Yaakov was going to get distracted. Because in giving him the blessings of a physical world, it meant that Yaakov was going to have to go out and work the physical world. And that would take him away from his Torah study and his avodah. So Rivka's plan was costly to Yaakov in a way, by getting him in to receive the blessings. She took him out of the tent. On the other hand, she felt she was saving him from starvation and being completely wiped out by not having any part of Olam Hazeh. Rav Shamshon Frohl Hirsch argues that Rivka and Yitzchak had this ongoing debate. Yitzchak insisted that Esav was really a good person, and that he was salvageable and redeemable, and Rivka said, you know, he's my son, but he's not a good person. And Rav Shamshon Frohl Hirsch says that their assessments were drawn from their upbringings. Yitzchak grew up in the presence of Avraham and Sarah, and Yishmael had been dispensed with. So he grew up in a very, very uncluttered, kind of innocent environment. And he believed people. Whereas Rivka grew up with a crook. She grew up with Bisuel and Lovan in her, but she knew what criminals looked like. She knew what these con artists were all about. And when she saw Esau, she knew that he was phony. So Yitzchak, who was innocent, believed him. And Rivka, who knew a con artist, when she saw him, said to Yitzchak, you're making a mistake. So Rav Shamshon Frohl Hirsch says that when this business with the blessing came up, she dressed up Yaakov, right? It was, the whole thing was kind of flimsy, right? And he goes in, and he deceives his father. And then Yitzchak, when it's all over, when Esau comes in, he realizes that he was taken in. But what he realizes, even more importantly, is how easily he was taken in. So Rav Shimon Frohl Hirsch says that what Rivka wanted to show him was that his innocence was so... That's what he said when he said, he says she was really right. Look at what I, you know, just... I'm really gullible. That's what he says, Gamberch, yeah, you know, like that. There it worked to the reverse, and that's an interesting thing, you know, that it says that Hashem heard Yitzchak's prayer rather than her prayer, even though they were both praying for the same thing. So some of the Foshim over there I can really hear it on my own bones. And it would seem, by the way, that God should have listened to her prayers rather than to Yitzchak's prayers, because she grew up in the presence of evil and was righteous, whereas Yitzchak grew up in the presence of righteousness and saintliness, you know, so big deal. So, you know, it's not much of a, doesn't seem to be much of an achievement. So it would seem that Rivka was really the bigger person. But these Mefarshim argue that to grow up in the presence of a very great person and the shadow of a great person, and to still on your own work somehow to establish yourself, that's higher than Torah. You know, if you grow up in Elul, so you look at this stuff. A person who has any discernment will see that this crookedness and wickedness is destructive. You know, so you define yourself against it. But to be in the presence of, to grow up in the presence of greatness, and nonetheless to strive to, when you say to yourself, well, I can never compete with that. I can never be that. So it's almost an invitation for somebody to say, I'll never be able to be that. I might as well just go out. And the fact that Yitzchak was not undone by that, was able to strive for his own greatness, that's what really established his greatness over Rivka. Sometimes the only way in which the powers of evil will allow something to happen is when they think they can stop it from happening, because the circumstances are so convoluted that nothing good could possibly come of it. That's the story with the daughters of Lot, the story of Yehud and Tamar, and all, you know, that entire. According to the way that we spoke about in the Shem Yishmol, she probably did tell Yitzchak, and Yitzchak believed that the older serving the younger was the way he could set it up. He could set it up with Esau serving Yaakov, and that's the way it was meant to be, and that's the way he would be redeemed. Esau was not interested in being any part of it. I want to tell you something. One of the ways in which we see this today is, in Jewish circles, is the fact that the feminist ethos has made its way into the religious quarters. Once upon a time, women understood that it was a noble calling to be an enabler, to be the mother who was in the house in a modest role, not out on the stage of life, not drawing attention to herself. Tznius, Kol Kavud Bas Melech Panima, the glory of a princess is concealed, it's inward. So women understood the fact that the greatest power in the world was in the hand that rocked the cradle. They knew what they were doing. They were imparting all the fundamental premises for people to grow up. If there was somebody who was a tzaddik, it was because he had a mother who knew how to shape that tzidkas. Meir Shapiro attributed everything he was. In any event, being an enabler was seen as a noble calling. Someplace, somewhere, the business that everybody had to be the star, and that being an enabler was of secondary importance and was offensive and insulting. That's destroyed everything. You know, instead of having homes where roles are understood, everybody is competing to be the person in the limelight. It should come as no surprise to us that we have this rocketing divorce rate, because everybody is busy fighting for who's first. And there's no enablers today. It's like the parents are filling out a form that their son has applied to a college. And the parents get an extra form to fill out. One of the questions that the parents are asked is your son a leader or a follower? So they wrote a follower. They got an express mail back saying your son is accepted. We have thousands of leaders and no followers.